BBC London 94.9.
London's news, London's stories.
Good afternoon, this is Ian Lee, filling in for Robert Elms. It's for one day only. I don't know where he is. He's probably sat in the park somewhere enjoying the sunshine. Good for him. So I'm here for the next 3 hours. Lots coming up between now and 3 o'clock, including we'll have a little bit of live music with Stephen Kellogg. You may remember him from the band The Sixers. He'll be in a bit later on. We'll be talking art, photographs and the like with Miles Aldridge. Siobhan Redmond is coming in to talk about rep. That's like proper acting, isn't it? And also we'll be finding out some art exhibitions with Alice Rawsthorn. But first of all, and this is where I really need your help, it's a Wednesday, okay? So it's notes and queries. So I'm kind of, you know, in an awkward position. I need you to call in with your various questions and your queries and your thoughts and your ponderings about things you may have seen in and around London. I don't need to explain this to you. You know it better than I do. Things you've seen, things you haven't seen for a long time, but you remember. Are you the only person that remembers it? Anything to do with mysteries or stories or legends of London. If you give us a call, we'll put it out to the listeners and we'll see if we can find the answers. The number is 020-7224-2000, 020-7224-2000. You can send me a text, 81333, start with London, or you can email me, robert.elms@bbc.co.uk. I've got access to his email system, so, you know, don't send any private emails for him until tomorrow. Any queries, any thoughts, any questions about London, get in touch and we'll do our best to solve them for you. This is Ian Lee, sitting in for Robert Elms. 020-7224-2000. And maybe we'll be speaking to you after this. That's The Staves, Mexico.
Lover, you may cause me tears, drag me through the best of years, but I love you so.
That's nice, isn't it? I'm a sucker when I could end that sentence there and it would still be appropriate. I'm a sucker when it comes to two girls or a girl singing nice bit of harmony, acoustic guitar. I'm in every single time. That totally makes me melt. Good afternoon. This is Ian Lee sitting in for Robert Elms. Robert is back tomorrow, so don't panic. And we are following the tradition of his Wednesday show and pursuing notes and queries. Any questions, any quandaries, anything you've spotted in or around London that you'd like answers to, then give us a call, 020-722-42000, and we will do our best to answer it. Now, I say we, I mean the other listeners, I won't know the answers. I did panic at the start of the show, thinking, well, no one's going to call in. I'm going to be sat here with egg on my face for the first hour of the show, having no one to talk to. Well, I'm very, very lucky, because Vic has called in his cab. Morning, Vic, or afternoon, Vic.
How are you? All
right? I'm fine, thank you very much, Vic. Are you enjoying this hot weather driving around in your cab?
No, it's tough work.
I don't want to be a naysayer, I don't want to be a pooper, but it's too hot, isn't it?
It is, we need rain.
We do. We need a nice thunderstorm to clear the air. And people go, oh no, we've only just got the sun. It's too hot. I can't sleep at night when it's like this, Vic.
I wake in the morning when it gets light.
Well, I didn't hear it, but it sounded traumatic. Vic, it's not the best line. What's your query for us?
In Dulwich Common.
Yep.
Near Lordship Lane.
Yeah.
South London. There's a wood called Springwood.
Springwood, Dulwich Common, yep.
And if you walk through Springwood,
yep,
you come to a railway tunnel that's boarded up.
Oh, mysterious.
And I don't know where it goes. I don't know what it is. But it'd be interesting to find out the history of it.
And this is a full-sized railway tunnel, so the old trains used to go underneath it.
Trains used to go through it, but I don't know where they used to run through, because there's, you know, it's just a wood, and then you come to a tunnel.
And there's no track or anything there anymore?
No, nothing. I don't even know where it ends up.
Have you not been able to find... You've not been able to follow it on the outside and find the exit?
No, you just go through the wood, and then on a track bed, you know, like a walkway.
Yeah.
It's not even a walkway. It's not like one of these ones that have been renovated, like the Highgate walkway. You just go along it, and then all of a sudden you come up against a tunnel.
And have you... Listen, whenever I come up against anything that's boarded up, I can't help but become a 12-year-old boy and try and find... through any gaps. Are there any gaps there? Any little holes that give anything away?
Children, I think people have walked through it, but it does say danger. No walking.
That danger, no walking. Naughty, don't do it. But you've never been tempted to just go in there and just hold your mobile phone up and have a little shine around?
I think I've done that. But Vic,
you're trying to be all innocent and play the naive, but you're just as naughty as me.
Yeah, but I'm 57 now.
Well, listen, and can I ask, as a 57-year-old man, did you get a little bit scared?
What, or tunnels?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's something, I don't think I'd like to go in there,
I don't think I'd come out. No, this is it, I turned 40 3 weeks ago, boy, was that the most depressing day of my life, but I still get a little bit scared of dark, empty buildings, churches at night time, don't even go there, and the thought of a tunnel in the middle of Springwood near Dulwich Common, it sounds exciting to me, but I would be too scared to pop my head round there.
The council should open it up and have people walk through it and charge them.
It's not a bad idea. There are so many little bits and pieces like this hidden away in woods and all over London. Yeah. I would happily pay... I'd pay a fiver, take me and the family down there, have a little walk through an old train tunnel.
Yeah, I mean, I'll try to find out a bit about it, but I can't seem to get anywhere.
Vic, just tell us exactly where it is again, and so if anybody's listening who might know, they know exactly what you're talking about.
Well, you come down Lordship Lane from Forest Hill. You turn left... Common, and immediately left there's a walkway. You can walk, it's like a wood, and you walk through the wood in a straight line, and you come to the tunnel.
All right, Vic. Listen, it's out there. Thank you very much. 020-722-42000. It does sound exciting, but he's in his 50s. I'm in my 40s. I think I have to say that now. I'm in my 40s. Ouch. But I would be a little bit scared to put my head around there. It's that kind of thing that you do when you're 12, 13. You're not supposed to, kids. The BBC do not in any way condone this sort of behaviour. But you put your head around there and you dare each other to go in there. I could never do that, even now as a grown man. If you know anything about this boarded-up tunnel, where it leads to, what it used to... Well, obviously, it was a train tunnel of some kind, but how long ago? If the tracks have been taken up, that would imply it was a long time ago that was used. And has it ever been opened? Has it ever been a little tourist attraction where, you get open house day and various open days where tunnels and caves and things are opened? Has that ever been part of that? I'd love some of that. 020-722-42000. Roy's in Addlestone. Morning. I keep saying good morning. I do apologise. That's from a previous life. Afternoon, Roy.
Good afternoon, Ian.
Good afternoon, Roy. What have you got for us? What's your query?
Well, I'm hoping that your listeners can help me with something that's been bothering me for 60 years.
Oh, blimey. Oh, 60 years you've had this burden?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Tell us what it is. They'll be able to do it, Roy. I've heard them before. They're excellent.
Every confidence. Well, this concerns an army training film.
Yeah.
That we were shown at school. You know, we were in what it was called, the Combined Cadet Force in those days. And one of the French masters, he was mad keen on anything to do with films. So we bought a projector for the school, and one of the first films he got hold of, I suppose in order to regularise it in case anybody wondered what we were all up to, he showed us this army training film to do with methods of house-to-house fighting. In other words...
Oh, yeah, that's what we need to teach youngsters. Show them a film in school on how to fight each other.
Well, this was serious stuff.
Yeah.
Now, on reflection, I can only assume that it was made to prepare people for the D-Day invasion.
Right. What kind of things were in this film then, Roy? Without going into too graphic details, we've got young ears. What sort of tricks was it showing you?
Well, it was showing you how to avoid sniper fire.
Oh, just out of interest, how do you avoid sniper fire?
Very, very carefully, I should think.
Of course you do, yes.
That sort of thing. How to the best way to clear a building, that sort of thing.
Yep.
Right? Now, everything in this film was made to look as if it was a typical town or village in Germany. The street names were German.
Yep.
The names above the shops were German. What traffic signs there were German. And when it was all over, he said, now then, he said, where do you think that was shot? And we said, well, in some film studio, sir, or in some, you know, we just didn't have a clue. And he said, it was in South London, he said. And I thought, really? But he should know.
Well, yes.
So I'm just wondering whether anybody but me, you know, either remembers it or knows where it was.
Okay, right. Let's try and get a bit more about this, Roy. So when did you see this film?
Well, it would have been while I was still at school. So it would have been 1951 or 52.
And how old was the film? Was it from the Second World War?
I should imagine it was, yes.
So probably about 1943, 44, something like that?
Yes.
Okay.
I guess it would have been made by some organisation called the Army Kinema Corps.
The Army Kinema Corps. Hmm. And do you remember a name? Did it have a title?
Well, it would have had something really sort of mundane, like street fighting or house clearance or something like that.
But again, showing a film to a bunch of boys in a school called Street Fighting. Imagine if they did that now, the uproar there'd be.
Don't forget, at the time
we
were shown this, there were chaps that were higher up the school that had gone into national service and ended up in Korea.
Of course.
So anything that we could pick up on the way might have been useful.
And it shows you, just in case anybody vaguely remembers seeing this at school, or there's a strong chance someone might have picked this up at a car boot sale or off on eBay. I went through a thing about 5-6 years ago of buying Super 8 silent films off of eBay and watching them. It showed you how to avoid sniper fire, how to clear a building.
Yes.
Anything else? Any other standout points?
Well, I mean, you're taking me back now. A long time, but I would have imagined that it would have dealt with things like how to deal with a machine gun post and things like that.
Wow.
You know, the sort of things that you would typically come across.
Yeah. Kids these days don't know they're born. Roy and Addleston, listen, thank you very much for that. It's out there. Well, that's a good one, isn't it? The first one, Vic in his cab, talking about the boarded up train tunnel, Springwood. Dulwich Common. I suspect we're going to get lots of calls on that. I suspect you're sitting at home. Don't wait for other people to do it. If you think you know something about it, give us a call. 020-722-42000. But Roy Addleston, army training film that told you how to deal with dodge snipers, deal with machine gun turrets and clear buildings from about, 43, 44, shot in South London. Does anybody else, first of all, remember that film? Did you get shown that film at school? Are you sat in your car going, oh, hang on a second, that's taken me back 50, 60 years. I know exactly what he's talking about. Or do you know anything about the film? Where it comes from? What it was called? And more importantly, was it really shot in South London? Did they mock up South London to look like Nazi Germany for this film? Sounds incredible if that's the case. 81333, start your texts with London. 020-722-42000. You can email if you want, robert.elms@bbc.co.uk. This is one of the best songs of all time. The Monkees, Pleasant Valley Sunday. It literally doesn't get any better than that. It's The Monkees, Pleasant Valley Sunday. They start a new tour in 6 days' time. Oh, it's in the States. I went last year. Cannot justify the cost to my wife this year. 8:00, this is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. I'm sitting in for Robert Elms just for today. He's back tomorrow. Don't panic. We're still doing the usual bits and pieces that that Robert does, including notes and queries. I was worried no one would call in. You've been very, very anxious to get in touch. We've spoken to Vic, who's talking about. He's been asking about the mystery railway tunnel. It's all boarded up. It's in Dulwich Common in Springwood. There's no tracks there anymore. He wants to know what it is, where does it lead to, and when was the last time it was open? Has anyone been in there? Have you seen it? First of all, have you seen it? And do you know when it was decommissioned? 020-722-42000. We also spoke to Roy, who saw an army training film in the early 50s, probably from the Second World War, that he thinks was filmed in South London, and it had South London decked out as Nazi Germany. Sounds quite an aggressive thing. It shows you how to dodge sniper fire and to take down a machine gun turret. If you know anything about that film, I know this is going to pan out. We'll get loads of calls about the train tunnel. None about the film. The film is the one I want to pursue. If you know anything about this film, did you get shown it at school? Maybe you or your dad or your granddad maybe even worked on the film. Was it really filmed in South London? And we've had a comment on the Facebook page from Jim. Hello, Jim. It says, I saw this on a wall in St James's Park on the back wall of a house in St Anne's Gate. What's it doing there? I've noticed it for over 30 years, but I've no idea why it's there. I shall try and describe it to you. It's a mosaic. It looks like a mosaic, kind of blue and grey. There is a picture of a naked gentleman. Woo-woo. Who's don't worry, his naughty bits are covered by a blue towel or a throw or something. He's wearing, it looks like a blue hat. He's holding a sword. In front of him, it is an L. Of course it's an L. Okay, I can see how this works. It says in rather swirly writing, Lictor. And the L looks like a Roman column, and it's placed in I think I can say the word phallic on BBC London 94.9. It's placed in a rather phallic position. So, what on earth is that? This is on a wall in St James's Park, on the back wall of a house in St Anne's Gate. Any idea what that is? It looks fantastic. It's very stylish. I mean, you wouldn't want it up on your wall. It's a little bit mucky. But it looks very stylish. Has anyone seen this? So, we've got those three. These three, I think, will do us for today. Dear London, it's over to you. I'm merely the conduit that throws these bits and pieces out. It's up to you to give us the answers, if you wouldn't mind. The tunnel, the boarded up tunnel, Dulwich Common, Springwood. How long's it been there? What's it for? When was the last time it was used? 0207 224 2000. The army training film that Roy saw in the 1950s that taught him the useful skill of how to dodge sniper fire. When I asked him how you dodge sniper fire, he said very carefully. He's got a point. He's got an excellent point. And also, this mosaic that's on the Facebook page, posted up there by Jim, on a wall in St James's Park, the back wall of a house in St Anne's Gate. I've noticed it for over 30 years. So, it's quite old. Lictor, what does that mean? L-I-C-T-O-R. I think it's an L. I'm guessing it's an advert for something. I don't know what. The picture gives away no clues. An advert for nudity? An advert for blue towels? Over to you, London. 020-722-42000. Right. Oh, look at the time. It's 12:30. Let's get the news now. Here's Anna Cooksham. Hello, this is Ian Lee, sitting in for Robert Elms. I'm so lucky doing this, because Notes and Queries is, of course, legendary. And it's one of my favourite bits of radio. I'm getting to host it. It's like I've stepped inside the radio. I was worried no one would get in touch. Lots of you have. Thank you so much. We've got three, queries that we're going to stick with, I think, for today. Let me give you a little recap of what they are. The first one was Vic, who called up in his cab. He's discovered, I don't think he's discovered it, but he's aware of the mystery railway tunnel in Springwood in Dulwich. There's no tracks there anymore. You just kind of walk along and suddenly there's a boarded up tunnel. He says boarded up. He has hinted that he's put his head around the boards a little bit to have a look. But even at the age of 57, he got a little bit scared. He got scared. You would. There's something about the pitch black darkness, isn't there, of tunnels that just turns you into an 8-year-old child that's got a complete irrational fear. Well, if you know anything about this tunnel, 020 722 42000. Roy in Addleston called him. When he was at school in the 50s, he watched an army training film. It sounds very violent. It was for the army, so I guess it would be. How to dodge sniper fire and how to take down a machine gun turret. He thinks it was shot in South London. His teacher at the time told him it was shot in South London. It was made up to look like Nazi Germany. Do you know anything about this? Can we find anybody else that's seen this film and knows if it was actually made in South London? Where was it in South London? 020-722-42000. If you go to the Facebook page, there is a mural that's been posted on the Facebook page. And we're trying to find out exactly what it is. Jim's posted it. Saw this on a wall in St James's Park on the back wall of a house in St Anne's Gate. What's it doing there? I've noticed it for over 30 years. No idea why. It's a mosaic. It's a picture of a naked fella. He's in good condition as well. He's got a towel or a blanket or something over the naughty bits. And the word Lictor, I think, in very swirly writing. L-I-C-T-O-R. Any idea what that is? It's a blonde man, blue cap, floating blue cape. Oh, Victor? Is that a V or an L? We're having a debate here already. See, I would say an L, but it could be a V. The only reason I'm saying it's the L is because the first downward stroke of the letter, very firm, very strong, like a pillar, like a Roman pillar. And the rest of it a little bit... It could be a V. Could be a Victor. Victor or Lictor. I mean, Victor would make more sense. That's a word. Well, we're stuck. We need your help. Over to you. 020-722-42000. You can email robert.elms@bbc.co.uk. You can send me a text, 81333. Start with London. Any help on any of these will be gratefully appreciated. This is Ian Lee, sitting in for Robert Elms. We'll speak to Alice Rawsthorne next. Here's a question. What happened to Norina Paolo? She was big, wasn't she, a few years ago? She did that brilliant album. I can't remember what the album was called, but it was so successful. She did it quite low budget that she went and re-recorded it, I think, with a big orchestra. And it was lovely. It was wonderful. Sophia was the song, I think, was the big hit. And I thought it was great. She's kind of, you know, sort of disappeared a little bit, which is... It's concerning, but I'm sure she's absolutely fine. Hello, good afternoon. This is Ian Lee, sitting in for Robert Elms. Just for today, don't panic. He'll be back tomorrow. I'm joined now by Alice Rawsthorne. Good morning. I keep doing good morning. Look, this
good
is
good lunchtime.
Good lunchtime to you. It's my other head is a morning head. This is an afternoon. How are you, Alice? You're right.
But it really doesn't feel like the afternoon yet, does it?
No,
it's
it
not
doesn't.
1 o'clock yet.
Is it still too hot out there?
It can never be too hot. Alice. And let's face it, with our terrible weather for most of the year, and I speak as a Mancunian, we're much as I love my home city, it is even wetter than London, I have to confess. How can we possibly complain about the sunshine?
I'm not complaining. It'd be good if we could just get access to God's thermostat. Just turn it down 2 degrees. It will just be a little bit more effective.
I just think we should be grateful for every last ray.
Alice, what have you got for us? You're the design critic of the International Herald Tribune.
I am.
And you've been off looking at various exhibitions and bits and pieces for us, have you?
Indeed. And as ever, there's tons going on the London art and design scene. And last week, there were two fantastic openings at Tate Modern. Both of the work of contemporary African artists. And... contemporary art from Africa is an area that the Western art world, Britain included, has pretty much neglected for many,
many years. I was
going to
say, contemporary African art is not a phrase I've heard bandied around too often. Is there a thriving contemporary art scene there?
There is. I mean, it's still quite a small contemporary art scene, but it's certainly thriving and very dynamic. And I think it's a phrase we're going to hear much, much more. And perhaps inevitably, because of our own colonial history, whenever Britain has looked at African art or Afro-Caribbean art, it has tended to be very much sort of referencing what has happened to immigrants from those countries when they've come to Britain.
Yep.
And obviously that's an enormously important area of our cultural heritage and something that artists can help us to understand and come to terms with. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But we have tended to neglect the work that's come out of African countries. And, you know, there's a popular presumption that very little artist work goes on there. Absolutely not true. I mean, obviously, a lot of African countries are in a terrible state politically and economically.
Yeah.
And, you know, if any art schools ever opened, either during the colonial era or since then, they're often closed by repressive
governments.
But then
that's sometimes when the best art does happen. Art is driven, can be driven, by pain and people's misfortune and you know, being in terrible situations. So I'm guessing that can be a big influence on some of the art.
It can, though, and obviously that's an incredibly complex subject. I mean, as a statement, it's absolutely true. And certainly if you look at virtually every area of British culture, not just the visual arts, but theatre, literature, cinema, much of our sort of best national work has always come out of social realism. Mm. So, you know, from kitchen sink drama from the 50s and 60s onwards. And the same applies to artists, writers, dramatists, from other countries. But I think if you are under a repressive and brutal dictatorship, then actually, you know, art coming out of the pain is pragmatically so difficult to be realised that it is almost a sort of a luxury for the Western world, which is not to say that there have been many extraordinary artists who've done extraordinary work in absolutely impossible circumstances, but also a lot of African artists have left their countries and have made their names and reputations elsewhere.
So what have we got at the Tate Modern?
What we've got at Tate is the work of two artists from very different parts of Africa, and they have they're from different generations, and they've worked in very different ways. So the first is by an artist from Benin called Meshack Garba, and he has done a massive exhibition. I think it's in eight of those huge galleries at Tate Modern, and it's called the Museum of Contemporary African Art. And this is a project that began many years ago, actually in the Netherlands, at the Stedelijk Museum. And he has conceived this sort of imaginary museum of contemporary African art. So he's made all the work, all the exhibits, and he adds to it with each new sort of iteration of the project every time it's exhibited somewhere else. He's also conceived the museum cafe, a museum shop, and also an incredible library full of books that have been donated for the project. And there's even a little children's library. So you could spend a really long time and have an absolutely lovely time in this exhibition, because it's not only a fascinating exhibition, because he calls it the Museum of Contemporary African Art. I mean, it's a sort of joke, because no such thing actually exists in a formal sense. So he felt free to invent his own. And he returns to the same sort of subject matter and symbolism again and again over the years in the new work he makes for the exhibition. So there's lots of work to do with money. And, you know, so he invents his own banknotes. He creates money trees. There are sort of piles of money, heaps of money. He also does lots of work with clothing, sort of working with it in different ways. There's a piano you can play. There are lots of things that you can really enjoy.
Right.
Participating
so you can get
in
your hands on and touch
completely.
Things. See, those are the best exhibitions.
I have to say, I was longing to play the piano because I can't. All I can play on the piano is chopsticks, and I don't think I've played that since I was six.
Well, you should have had a go, though.
I felt far too embarrassed to have a go, and let's face it, I had no right to expect other people to listen to it.
I think
that was the rub. But it's a really fascinating exhibition, because it tells you so much about his vision of his culture, and also because he's added all these different components to it, the T-shirts in the shop, this huge library full of really amazing books.
What kind of books are in the library?
Art books. So amazing art magazines from Africa, because there is a sort of thriving zine culture and internet culture. There are also these bikes that he produced for one exhibition, which actually have sort of, you know, old school computers on, the ones that used to be described as greyish, because before the Apple Mac, you know, every computer was that sort of greyish shade of beige.
They're on bikes?
They're on bikes.
What?
And so you can actually have access to websites from contemporary art institutions all over Africa. So really interesting art schools, you know, a contemporary art foundation in Ghana that supports Ghanaian artists, puts on exhibitions, has workshops in craft as well as art. So you can investigate all of this. So in other words, it gives you an amazing insight into what is really happening in contemporary art in Africa, as well as this really fun, as well as politically incisive artist vision.
So this is at the Tate Modern.
This is at Tate Modern. And Tate Modern has acquired everything for its collection. So I think certainly physically it's the biggest ever acquisition.
Okay.
God knows where or how they're going to store it. I think the idea is it will tour to many other museums all over the world. So I found it absolutely fascinating.
Okay, now what's happening at Whitechapel?
Well, also at Tate Modern is another African art show. And this is by an older African artist, Ibrahim El Salahi, from a completely different part of Africa. He's from Sudan. And he is an artist in a much more traditional sense. He is an absolutely wonderful painter. And he has experimented.
Proper art. Paintings are proper
old-fashioned
art.
Old-fashioned art. But he is a painter in the best possible sense, in that he is constantly sort of inquisitive and experimental with his work. His work is always distinctive. It could only be his work. And and yet he experiments with lots of different forms of painting. So, you know, in certain periods of his life, it's figurative, other periods, quasi-abstract, in, you know, yet more completely abstract. And he moved around the world a great deal. He actually studied at the Slade School of Art in London, where he did a sort of a personal research project in London's museums. And he has retained very close links with Britain and has indeed ended up living here throughout his life. But because he was very committed to his country, he returned to Sudan and became part of what was called the Khartoum School of artists in the 50s and 60s, who were a sort of generation of very dynamic modern artists, yeah, working in the Sudan. But politically, things became very, very difficult for artists and intellectuals in Sudan when a more repressive regime took control in the 1970s. At one point, he came back to London. He worked at the Sudanese embassy here. He was then recalled to Sudan, and he felt he should go to help his compatriots. And he carried on working throughout. But he was imprisoned after yet another coup in Sudan. So he was in a notoriously brutal jail in a cell with 20 other people for 6 months, but still carried on working on scraps of paper, yeah, you know, making marks with bits of dirt he found on the prison floor. And then when he was let out of prison, he left the country. And at first he stayed in the Gulf, but he now lives rather oddly in Oxford, which he is absolutely devoted to, and has carried on working throughout this period.
It's an odd place to end up after spending so long in Sudan and various prisons and travelling all around the world. He's ended up in Oxford.
He's an incredibly sophisticated urbane man. Not that many people in Oxford are not, of course. Oh, it's just that you would have expected him to have ended up in a metropolis. You know, come back to London, Paris, New York, Berlin, wherever. But anyway, he has carried on working, and it is an incredible body of work. And one of the lovely things about these big survey shows at both Tate Modern and Tate Britain, the Lowry Show at Tate Britain is another example, is they can really give you an opportunity to discover and understand the work of an extraordinary artist who's produced an incredible body of work over the years that's sort of constantly changing, reflecting their own experience, reflecting their political observations and their observations of the world. And this is such an exhibition. I mean, Ibrahim El-Salahi is already a hugely sort of well-respected figure within the art world. He's not necessarily well-known by a wider public, but he's hugely respected by his peers, by art historians, by critics and curators. But he has never had as large an exhibition as this before in Britain. So it's a wonderful opportunity to see it.
Okay.
And it's a fantastic pairing. Meshek Garba's a much younger artist. I think he's probably in his 40s. And so obviously has a very different experience as an artist. And also has, although his work is, also deeply political and has a great deal to say about, you know, contemporary African culture, there's a cheekiness and an irreverence.
I like a cheekiness
to it.
I do like a bit of cheek. I like a bit of humour in art. Sometimes art can be a bit dour, I find, a little bit straight. I like a nice little kind of cheeky wink.
Well,
every
I
now
think
and
you
then.
Would really, really yeah. enjoy the show. I mean, Ibrahim El-Salahi, you are sort of in awe of an extraordinary artist. Not that there isn't an underlying humour there, but that's really not sort of the objective of his work. Whereas Meshek Garba's work, it does have that cheeky little wink that
I'm going to play a quick record.
We'll
come back on this. We've got a couple more. I want to hear about the Spirit of Utopia exhibition. I also want to hear about the experimental sound in Eastern Europe. So stay there, Alice. We'll have a little song. We'll be back after this. He's so fun. I think that's a Phil Spector song. I imagine it would be. The reason I bring that up is I'm thoroughly enjoying Al Pacino as Phil Spector. Watching that at home on my Sky Plus. Oh, it's a treat.
Oh, I am so looking forward to seeing
the
that.
Wigs. It's all about the wigs. And Pacino's just one of them. And it's the first thing I've ever seen where you see how tall Al Pacino really is, because Phil Spector's tiny as well. And so you see Al Pacino as the tiny man he is. I think he's 5'1".
Really? That is very, very
charming. He's something like that. Alice Rawthorne is here. We've not got much time. We've got a few more to cram in. So where do you want to go first?
Okay, well, very quickly, we'll go to the Whitechapel Gallery in East London for the Spirit of Utopia, which is the Whitechapel's big summer show. And this is a fantastic exhibition. The basic premise is that the sort of modernist vision of a perfect utopia, this amazing future we could all aspire to and, you know, eventually benefit from, is now over, tarnished. It won't happen.
Have we missed
it?
And
so new visions of the future are being developed. So it looks at the work of 10 artists from all over the world who have devised alternative, often dystopian visions of the future. And so there are some really interesting artists in the exhibition. So among my favourites are Theaster Gates, who's one of the most interesting artists working today. He's an African-American artist activist who's very, all his work is very collaborative, it's very interactive, and he has set up a sort of pottery school in the Whitechapel. And so a master potter teaches a series of apprentices how to throw pots during the course of the exhibition. And it makes you think of the history of pottery, the arts and crafts movement, which was very active in the area of East London.
I don't like doing pottery. I don't like having dirty hands. I get very, and you do, obviously you get dirty with pottery. It makes me feel uncomfortable. I like watching people do it because it's an amazing thing, seeing that clay spinning round and the
but
shape.
But in that case, you'll be very happy because I'm not
watching.
Sure you're allowed to participate in this, but the apprentices are. And there's also a fabulous installation called The Sanatorium by the Mexican artist Pedro Reyes. And visitors, it's a series of sort of psychological tricks that visitors can encounter, but it also does tell you something about yourself. So a really dynamic exhibition, not a conventional one for an art gallery, but very, very interesting, with a bit of aquaponic food growing technology thrown into boot. So well worth going to the Whitechapel to see that.
Now, something that Robert was talking about yesterday, Club to Catwalk, 1980s fashion exhibition at the V&A.
Indeed.
Well, the V&A are doing lots of these kind of exhibitions where they get loads of... They had the David Bowie thing recently, didn't they?
Which is still on.
Is it still going?
It is still on. I suspect it closes quite soon.
Right.
Well, Club to Catwalk, for me, because I went to the clubs, wore all the clothes, is a complete nostalgia fest, as I'm sure it is for Robert too. And it's a fairly conventional V&A fashion exhibition in that it's sort of clothes on mannequins. But it's very broad. There are some of the more conventional designers from the 1980s, sort of Bruce Oldfield, Jasper Conran, Victor Adelstein, but also the sort of clubby ones too. So Body Map, who I absolutely loved, Vivienne Westwood in her sort of radical experimental heyday, Pam Hogg, so on and so on, Lee Bowery's amazing costumes. So as a sort of walk along nostalgia lane, it's fantastic. And then there is an amazing multimedia installation which has lots of footage sort of from the clubs,
fantastic.
Pop promos. So that really brings a sort of style culture, what it was like to life. I think there was a lovely quote in The Guardian yesterday from the curator of the exhibition saying when they were installing it, her staff kept on going missing. She'd always find them dancing there.
Isn't that brilliant? These things that are within living memory. It's amazing. The 80s look like a foreign country, don't they? It looks like it was so long ago because of the changes in style and fashion and...
Well, actually, I'm not sure they do. The 80s, certainly if you see footage of the 80s in the street, it looks like the 1950s. It was so drab, so dreary.
Very smoky.
So poor. You know, it was the sort of Thatcherite economic iron fist and London was, you know, a very poor, very deprived, very drab city. But the clothes, of course...
Glam.
So many of, you know, so much of the symbolism, the shapes, the references of their clothes have come back and back again and again.
Alice, we're running out of time.
So actually, a lot of it looks very familiar.
20 seconds, because I want to hear this
very
is the,
quickly,
like, sounds like my favourite, experimental sound
very
in Eastern
interesting.
Europe.
This is the work of experimental artists and musicians in Eastern Europe during the Cold War.
Oh, this sounds wonderful.
So from 1957 to 1984, like the African art shows at Tate Modern, completely surprising. Incredible work. Artists and musicians that we hitherto haven't heard of here, and this is at Calvert 22, also in East London, and that's on Calvert Avenue off Shoreditch High Street.
That's the one that's grabbed my attention most of all. Alice, very nice to meet you. Thank you so much for coming in.
They're lovely to meet
Alice
you.
Rawthorne, design critic of the International Herald Tribune. Right, it's time to get the travel now with Pippa Sparks.
BBC London 94.9.
London's news. London's stories.
afternoon. Hello, this is Ian Lee sitting in for Robert Elms. I got it right. It's afternoon. Congratulations to me. Well done. This is Ian Lee. Robert Elms is having the day off. He's back tomorrow. Don't panic. He's allowed to bunk off when the weather's like this. He works very hard most of the time. BBC London 94.9. We're still doing all of Robert's normal features coming up before the end of the show. We've got some live music with Stephen Kellogg. Miles Aldridge, the photographer, is coming in. If you've been on the Tube recently, you'll have seen loads of adverts for his book and his exhibition that's taking place. And coming up in the next 5-10 minutes or so, I'll be speaking to Siobhan Redmond. We're still doing notes and queries today. I was worried none of you would call in. You've not let me down, London. Oh, you've been very helpful. Well, I say helpful. Helpful in as much as you set us three things we're trying to find out. Vic called in from his cab. There's a mystery railway tunnel in Springwood in Dulwich. Does anyone know anything about it? What it was used for? When it was boarded up? When it became redundant? Can you get little tours in there? Wouldn't it be nice if we all met up there one day with our torches and went and had a little look in there? 020-722-42000. Then we spoke to Roy in Addleston. Now, this is the one that I suspect will stump even you. And I know you're good at this because I listen to the show regularly. I know that very, very rarely does Robert pose a question or a query that can't be answered. I think this may be one of those times. Roy in Addleston, in the 50s, he was shown in school an army training film that showed you how to avoid snipers. And when I asked him, well, how do you avoid snipers? Very carefully. OK, fine. How to take down sentry posts and machine gun turrets. Probably filmed mid-40s, during the World War II, anyway. It was made to look like Germany. German signs, German soldiers. But he was told it was shot in South London. Now, we need to find out what this film was called. Oh, I want to go. Maybe it's worth having a little look on YouTube. It's the kind of thing that turns up on YouTube, isn't it? What the film was called. Was it really shot in South London? And if so, where? 020-722-42000. You can text as well. 81333. Start your text with London. And Jim has posted on the Facebook page a mosaic that he's seen on a wall in St James's Park on the back wall of a house in St Anne's Gate. What is it? He's noticed it for 30 years. It looks in pretty good condition. I don't think it's going to be an ancient Roman artefact. It's a nudie fella, very muscular, who's got a sort of blue robe covering his naughty bits. There's a word, well, we think it says Victor. It's one of those curly, it's all curly letters. It's hard to make it out exactly. Lictor, Victor. Go and have a look on the Facebook page. And if you can spot what it is, I think you know what it means. 020-722-42000. Robert.Elms@bbc.co.uk. Now, this is a cracking song. We were debating today whether this song was too soft for us to play or not. Well, it turns out that maybe the computer won't play. Let me see if I can drag it up from here. I tell you why, because it's Chicago. I like a little bit of Chicago, but we weren't sure whether this was going to be too soft. I think for a nice sunny afternoon, this is perfect. 020-722-42000. You see, I think a little bit of Chicago is fine in the weather like this. It's kind of been a bit slow and a bit sluggish. It's nice, it's romantic, I believe. I don't know if anyone considers Chicago to be romantic in the year 2013. I do. It's because I'm a gentleman. This is Ian Lee sitting in for Robert Elms, BBC London 94.9. You can give me a call about any of the things we're talking about this afternoon if you want. 020-722-42000. Now, listen, I suppose in this kind of weather, the theatres are perhaps the last place you want to be sitting in, because it can be so hot, but don't let that put you off going. Siobhan Redmond joins me now. Hello, Siobhan.
Hello there.
Your theatre, is it air-conditioned?
Yes, it is air-conditioned. There was a slight blip at the weekend. I think that's been rectified now.
Really?
I went to see the show upstairs on Saturday night and it was a very hot bunny, but I think it's sorted out now.
Now, let's explain why you're here. You're currently one of the cast in the Royal Court's weekly repertory.
Yeah.
As part of the Open Court Writers Festival, the theatre has created a rep theatre company. Well, it's an old-fashioned tradition, isn't it, that we've not had in Britain for years, where there will be a theatre company and they would do a play a week and that play would rotate. And why has it been brought back for this?
Well, when Vicky Featherstone took over at the Royal Court, when she looked at the programming, she realised there was a kind of six-week turnaround time where Dominic, the outgoing director, hadn't programmed anything and before her season actually started. So she asked everybody who worked in the building which writers they would most like to work with again. Mm. And then she got all of those writers together on Valentine's Day, the Valentine's Day massacre, as she put it. And she asked, she said, you can have the building for 6 weeks. You can do what you want.
Fantastic.
And Carol Churchill said, well, why don't we have, amongst other things, a rep company?
Oh, thanks, Carol.
Yeah, thank you.
I study performing arts. I've had to suffer under Carol already, so go on, yes.
I myself think that Carol should be made to be prompt for 6 weeks, that she should be there every night, but that hasn't happened yet, and we've only got one more week to go after this. So there are 14 actors,
right?
And we're only part of what's going on at the court, because there's all sorts of stuff. There's surprise theatre where you can get a dinner for 15 quid and you pay 10 quid to see a show and you don't know what it's going to be.
Oh, that's very exciting.
Yeah, but it was Mark Ravenhill one night.
Wonderful.
Romola Garry. There's been all sorts of people doing a surprise show ups. Even we who are working in the other bits of the building don't know what it's going to be.
Isn't that exciting?
Yeah,
I like things
thrilling.
Like that.
Thrilling. I don't know if the menu works that way. I don't know if you just get given what you're given.
What's
or
this?
If you get to choose.
This is has anyone walked out of this? They've paid their money for the surprise theater. No, to be honest, this isn't what I was expecting. Come on, let's go.
No, they haven't, because it's quite teeny, you see, and it takes quite a lot of front to do
to
that.
Get up and walk
it?
Out,
yeah?
Yes.
But I don't think they've wanted to anyway.
Good. No, I'm
playwright
sure it sounds
at your table where you pay money and a playwright will read some of their work to you. Proper grown-up playwrights. Lost in Theatre, there's lots of like treasure hunts around the building. You pick up some headphones, find yourself a play to listen to. There's a soap opera based in Peckham, where they're having an omnibus edition going out this weekend. There's all sorts of stuff going on in the bar on Friday nights.
Back to the one about the playwrights reading to you.
Yeah.
That sounds wonderful. How does that work?
Well, take your seats and listen, it says here, as leading playwrights read you their play in a secret location around the building. So, a playwright read his play to seven people in the ladies' loo on Saturday morning. That one's sold out, but there are day tickets available on the door.
See, things like that I find really exciting, because there is this perception, and it's wrong, but there is still a perception by some people, oh, the theatre, it's very elitist, oh, it's very stuffy, and it's wrong. And it's interesting tricks like this that I think kind of demystify the theatre.
Yeah. And I think the other good thing about this, Ian, is that because the ticket prices reflect the kind of ad hoc nature of the thing, so they're lower than they usually are.
Yep.
So people who wouldn't normally think of going to the Royal Court are coming. Mm. And that's great. And a lot of really young people are coming. Not that the Royal Court demographic doesn't include young people, but theatre going is a habit. And if you don't get it early in life, you probably won't get it later on, because it's an expensive bad night out.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
This is why things like theatre to a lot of people is Jersey Boys. No disrespect to Jersey Boys.
Yeah,
I took my mum. It's a cracking show.
Yeah.
But there is more to theatre than someone's greatest hits being loosely linked by a story.
Yeah,
and indeed. You're right about young people. My boy, my eldest boy, 3 and a half, and ever since he was a baby, we took him to live little shows for kids, and then we took him to a theatre recently to see The Tiger Who Came to Tea. And it's that experience of making it normal to sit in a theatre with a couple of hundred other people and watch a live performance, live music and live actors. It's amazing, and a lot of kids don't get that, do they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the show that was on in the rep company sequence a couple of weeks ago, Pigeons, I think was marketed quite heavily at kids who were still at school. Mm. And I saw that show, because I wasn't involved in that one. I saw that one on a night when I was surrounded by kids who were having a ball. They were really having a brilliant time. So it's fantastic. And also, we've got a few ambulance chasers, I'd be willing to bet. People who think, right, you've had a week to learn this. You're not going to remember it. Are you?
Well, is that how it works? You have got a week to learn.
Got a week.
Are they new plays?
Yes, they are. You see, that's the thing that didn't used to happen in the days of Weekly Rep. In the days of old Weekly Rep, you'd get your copy of, I don't know, Lady Windermere's Fan, French's acting edition, which would have all the directions written out in it. So you knew, at that point, I stand by the window.
Yeah.
All of that kind of stuff, and you learn it in advance. Well, you can't do that with a new play, because it will be changing. There will be things put in, there will be things taken out, as the writer gets an opportunity to see how it works with an audience. So yes, it is quite
scary. It
sounds
like a nightmare. Why are you you can't be desperate for work. Why are you doing it?
If somebody throws down the gauntlet like that / offers you that opportunity, you have to do it. Because I didn't anticipate this would be the case, but I work in classical theatre quite a lot, where you get the privilege to work on a big Rory play that's lasted for hundreds of years, for a very good reason, over a long period of time. To actually have to learn a comedy, which is what we're doing this week, is not only a comic play, but it is very funny. To have to learn how to do that in a week is a completely different thing. And we've got faster at it. We are now a sort of...
It's a skill you develop,
group
isn't
of
it?
Acting samurai. I don't know if that's a skill that you can use anywhere else.
Have you got any cheats? Have you got... We were talking about soaps before you came on the air. Have you got, you know, half a page of script in the teapot and something stuck on in a drawer somewhere you can read?
Well, those who can still see without the aid of glasses might have that kind of thing. I don't know. That's no use to me. Because if I can see to read, I can't see what's on the faces of the other actors I'm on stage with. So I either know it or I don't. But we have got, in the play that we're doing at the moment, there is a little bit of what might be audience participation, what might be audience intervention, what might be carefully planned. So Vicky, who's running the Royal Court, has very carefully built in a sort of a framework that's got several layers. So if it came to it, you could ask for help, but nobody has yet.
Well, hang on a second. What do you mean you can ask for help in a play?
The first play that we did was a Georgian play about the events of one particular week in Georgia. And the central character was the president of Georgia. So that it was a hypothetical meltdown for him. So he finds himself out on the streets in Georgia over the course of an evening, not knowing what's going to happen next. So within that setup, you could have somebody shouting instructions. You could have, as we did, a stage manager pushing the actor out onto the stage. So you don't know what's real and what isn't. It's not cheating, I swear to you. I've been doing this for 400 years. I was at school with God, and I've never been so frightened as I was last night.
It does sound terrifying, though.
It is.
It does sound, you know, you're kind of just clinging on with your fingernails, hoping everyone remembers where they're standing, what they're saying, what play you're doing this week. It must be exciting, though.
It's completely thrilling. And actually, you know, it means that you can't aim for anything other than getting what the writer wrote out accurately, intelligibly, and as honestly as you can. And frankly, that's what you should be doing all the time. Nothing fancy smancy.
And people are coming. People are coming and enjoying
this. They're loving it.
I'm getting anxious even thinking about it. Why did? Because Rep has died out, and it was the training ground for lots of you know, old school actors. Why did it die out, do you think?
I'm not sure. I think it might have been to do with finance. Most things in theatre usually are. You know, you're not going to hire 13 actors if you can get away with doing a play that only has three of them four times in a season. So there are fewer opportunities. There are still some theatres where it happens. They're very few and far between. Dundee Rep in Scotland has a core company of actors. And that's been going for 10 years now. That's amazing. But mostly it doesn't happen anymore. And I think it's possibly not just finance, but also taste, what we want to see plays about.
Well, I know that Debbie Chazen is in some. I worked with Debbie years
ago. Debbie
She's Chazen. Brilliant, isn't she?
A thrill to work with her.
I did a sketch show with her, and I think she was like a sexy vampire, and I was a vampire hunter, something like that. Who else is in there?
Oh, there's all sorts of people there. So there's seven men and seven women. Anna Calder Marshall. Alan Williams, Jonjo O'Neill, Debbie Chazen, Natasha Gordon.
I've just realised I put the pressure on you now.
That's all right.
If you forget a name, they'll be hungry. She didn't mention me.
I bet you one of your favourite actors is in this company. Come along and see.
It sounds very, very exciting. How much longer does it go on for?
We've got another 10 days to go with the Rep company. Yep. I finish this weekend and the boys finish next week. It's an all-male play next week. But there's all sorts of things going on. There's a kids' court where there's kids' plays going on up until the 20th.
Kids' plays.
Yeah, kids' plays.
Lovely.
A week of plays, workshops and special events curated by playwrights aged 8 to 11.
Oh, so they're written by play, by kids.
Yeah, go on the website. Go on the Royal Court website. You can get all this information
See,
there.
See, things like that, again, I find very exciting when it's kids that are in control. Because kids, no disrespect, I've got some. Yeah. They are bonkers, aren't they? And their idea, their imagination, they don't have the limitations that we as grown-ups have. Oh, you can't do that. Oh, no, you can't do that. We'll do it. And they just go and do it, which is wonderful.
Yeah, they're thrilling.
Do you think that theatres in London should be doing more things like this to try and encourage younger people who've not been to the theatre? You know, the pricing is important, but also the attitude is important as well, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. Well, like I said earlier, I think if we don't do that, we've had it, really. Because I think this is a very interesting time for theatre where, like, you know, you can't argue that theatre should have money when there isn't enough money for schools and hospitals, really. So we have to find ways of being attractive to our potential audience. And I think we can do that either by becoming more spectacular or more intimate or both of those things. Mm. More surprising, certainly.
Yes.
If you can make theatre a place where you can go and you don't have to pay too much and you know that you're in for something exciting you're willing to take a risk on, then we're laughing.
People will recognise you. You've done bits of telly. Mm. So as my mum would say, oh, she's a proper actor then. Has she been on the telly? Oh, she's proper. That's my mum's category. And you have done things like EastEnders and Doctors and things like that, where it is a very, very quick turnaround,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
I'd imagine there's kind of similarities between that and what you're doing now.
Yes.
With EastEnders in particular, now it's on like 8 days a week or whatever it is. Mm. What do you get? Two shots at it and then you're on to the next scene?
Well, I had a very happy 3 weeks on it. We were sort of shooting on location, so everybody was slightly giddy because, you know, they were away from where they normally were. I don't really know how they cope with it. I suppose they get match fit. Mm. You just develop a facility for doing it. But I did Doctors recently. It's the first one I've done, and I did it mainly because the guy who was directing it was somebody that I worked with on Holby City years before, and also because I was playing a would-be jumper and I like heights, so I wanted to be up on a roof. But my friend, the actress Maureen Beattie, said to me beforehand, I'm telling you now, you have to know this so well that if a madman breaks onto the set and starts hitting you with a dead cat, you will keep talking because there's only one chance. And there is. It's exactly like this. It's like tag team acting. It's thrilling.
Siobhan, it's lovely to meet you. Thank you so much for coming in. So just give the details of exactly where you are and how much longer you've got.
I'm at the Royal Court Theatre in Sloane Square. The whole season goes on until July the 20th. Check out the website. There's bound to be something there that you like.
Siobhan Redman, lovely to meet you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Afternoon, this is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9, sitting in for Robert Elms. Robert, it will be back tomorrow. Panic not. He'll be back tomorrow. 20 seconds. Let me remind you of the notes and queries we've thrown out there. Vic in his cab wants to know about the mystery railway tunnel in Springwood in Dulwich. We think we've got the answer on that. We think we know what we're doing there. The ones that we're struggling with a little bit, Roy and Addleston, the army training film, which he thinks was shot in South London. There's a possibility. Well, it turns out one or two of you may have called in. We think. 020-722-42000. And this mosaic that has been spotted by Jim on a wall in St James's Park on the back wall of a house in St Anne's Gate. It's a mosaic. It's a nudie fella. His modesty is covered by a blue kind of cloth. And the word Victor, we think, is spelt in that kind of flowery writing. He's got a blue cap, he's blonde, and he's holding a sword. Anything. Does that ring any bells with you? Is it an advert for, I don't know, soap or it'll be soap or beer or a washing powder or something, won't it? 020-722-42000, 81333. Start your text with London. We'll get the latest on that. And we'll also be speaking to Miles Aldridge in a little bit about his latest book and his latest exhibition. But before that, 1:30, let's get the news now with Anna Cooksom. Hello, this is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9, sitting in for Robert Elms. Lots to talk about this afternoon. Mystery railway tunnels, army training films possibly filmed in South London, a mosaic near St James's Park. If you know the answer to any of these things, 0207-224-2000. Coming up, talking to Miles Aldridge. He's a photographer. He's got a new exhibition, a new book. And if you've been on the Underground in the last week or so, you'll have seen some of his pictures because they're being advertised heavily on there. We'll be speaking to him shortly. If you want to send me a text, 81333. Start your text, London, and maybe I'll read it out after this. Teddy Thompson. If I'm honest, there are shades of Glen Campbell in his voice there, which is not a bad thing at all. Big fan of Glen. Glen Campbell's re-recorded all of his hits. That was an odd choice, if I'm completely honest. Now, joined by Miles Aldridge. Hello, Miles. They're all there, aren't you? Yes, there we go.
Here I am, yes.
You're all right?
I'm not bad, thank you.
Is it still ridiculously hot out there?
It's scorching out there, yes.
It's too hot, isn't it?
Yeah.
Too hot to...
Fry an egg on the sidewalk.
Just turn it down a little bit. Now, for those who don't know, Miles Miles Aldridge is a photographer. His work is shown in two London exhibitions this summer, as well as published in a book. Studied illustration at Central St Martin's. Worked in the fashion industry for 15 years. Your pictures, from what I can gather from this book, you have a style, don't you? There's a distinct style.
Yes.
Just come a little bit closer, if you don't mind.
Sure.
What I've picked up, beautiful, yet slightly bored-looking women. Is that correct? Is that...
I think they're not just bored. They're contemplating their lot, or, you know, what they've ended up with. Now they've managed to have it all, as it were.
They tend to be. I'm flicking through this book, but they tend to be in slight. Oh my goodness gracious! Oh my goodness, I wasn't expecting to see one of those.
There's some nudity, yes,
as I've just spotted. They tend to be pictured in slightly affluent situations, yes, don't they? So what is it? Is it kind of Stepford Wives type?
Well, the idea of the Stepford Wives, of course, were these sort of women created by men, you know, that sort of performed all the chores and so forth. But these women aren't that. These women are real humans with souls and feelings and thoughts. But they've been, because of sort of the consumer society, they've been, in a way, kind of turned to stone. Mm. So they're, as I said, you know, with all the trappings of luxury and beauty and elegance and all the things that we kind of told that we need to be happy, then wonder if they really are happy. And so, hence the title, I Only Want You to Love Me, is the title of the book and the exhibition. For me, that's sort of somebody saying, you know, I only got my hair done this way so you would love me, or I only had these fake boobs so you would love me, or this... this perfume is because I want you to love me. It's to do with buying things and owning things and coveting things.
Now, have you always kind of had that outlook, or is it as you're getting older? I turned 40 a few weeks ago, and it is, however you want to wrap it up, it is kind of a significant turning point, I think. I'm starting to realise, without getting too deep, I'm pretty spiritually bankrupt. You know, there's not a lot going on inside. Have you always had that sense that it's the materialistic isn't going to answer the questions, or has that grown on you as you've got older?
No, I've had that sort of outlook from quite early on in my career as a photographer. My sister was a very famous model in the 80s, and so would go on her photo shoots and see her transformed from a Kentish town girl into a sort of high class lady on a yacht with a martini. And I was sort of this trick, this kind of trickery of that I sort of witnessed. I felt that when I had a chance to say something photographically, that I wanted to send a different message, that, you know, that she's on the same yacht, but the yacht is on fire, sinking in the sea, something like that, you know.
You mentioned the martini. One of the pictures I spotted in this earlier is fantastic. It's of a beautiful mother, and there's a baby kind of in a cot, and she's ignoring him, and she's holding a martini in one hand, and he's kind of reaching out for it.
Yes.
It's a little bleak, isn't it, that sort of outlook?
Yeah. I you know, the message in the imagery is sort of sugar-coated, you know. Mm. It's sort of colourful, sexy, a lot to do with beauty, of course. But there is this sort of slightly troubling message, I think, that comes through through the work. For me, it's I think the job of the fashion photographer is not just to kind of say that the world is a beautiful, colourful place with beautiful people and everything's wonderful. I mean, just heard the news before I came on. I mean, the world is not like that, and so
it's a grim place. Yes,
it's a grim place. But, you know, so I think for me, the point of my work as a photographer is not just to kind of dress things up and say everything's great. It's I'm sort of hopefully working within a tradition of other photographers, like Richard Avedon and Helmut Newton, who not only documented the clothes and the looks of that period, but also reflected the sort of the zeitgeist and the feelings, and often those feelings that filmmakers and writers and musicians convey to us are about a rather unsettled world, not only a world of having it all. You know.
You mentioned Kentish Town. Is that where you grew up?
Yeah.
How does someone go from Kentish Town, a place I know very, very well, to becoming a photographer and an artist in this kind of field?
Well, I my story is it's quite well known how I've sort of fell into photography. It's sort of I'm a little kind of bored of saying it, but
you don't have to if you don't want to.
Well, you know, I to cut a short story, a long, long, boring story shorter.
Yeah,
you know, I fell into it. You know, I was in the right place at the right time. Kentish Town was as good a place as any.
Yeah,
actually, you know, the idea of coming from Kentish Town and being a bit rough around the edges was actually a bonus in around about 1996 when I started, so-called grunge years, where if you were from a sort of a tower block or a council estate, you had more chance of...
It was a bit trendy for a while, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. I mean, then transpired, it became sort of turned into what was known as heroin chic. And then it went back to glamour. So, you know, these sort of fashion movements of grunge.
And growing up in London, how has that affected your art?
I think London, I mean, I've lived a bit in Paris and in New York. And I think London is the great city where you can do the work, but you can also be incredibly private and think about the work. And so for me, you know, my advice to photographers is to think about the work rather than just start shooting and taking lots and lots of pictures. To sort of think about what you're trying to say with the work. And for me, being in London, you're able to do that in the way that in New York or Paris, they're just so small, those cities, that you're constantly being forced to work and be like in the middle of the machine, like working. In London, especially where I live, not far from Kentish Town, actually in Hampstead Heath, you can be very, you know, you can just vanish, and that's where I think the ideas tend to they tend to sort of drop in at those moments.
Do you still use old-fashioned film? I'm glad you do, because the thing now, it's everyone can buy at a reasonable price a fancy camera that does all the tricks, and because it's all on memory cards, you can take 500 pictures and keep two of them. So everyone thinks, "Oh yeah, photography is easy. I look at this photo of the baby; it's brilliant." And I think some of the skill and some of the respect for photography has kind of gone a little bit.
Yeah, and that's a real shame. I think digital has had a very negative effect on photography generally. It's kind of cheapened the idea of taking pictures. It seems incredibly throwaway. I think in response to that, I've made my photography harder and harder to do. So I work on larger and larger format film, which is a slower process, and the whole action of taking photographs on a camera with film instead of a digital camera is that you're constantly uncertain as to whether you've got this picture or not, and therefore you work so much harder to get the picture that you go beyond the picture to find a new image that wasn't even there. I think when you're working digitally, you're doing two things: you're taking pictures and then you're looking at pictures, and it's that taking and then looking and taking and looking back and forth that takes your eye off the target, really. And I think you're possibly too easily satisfied with a picture that looks like the one you thought you wanted to take, whereas just going endlessly forward, driven by anxiety that you're not getting this picture, you get a pretty interesting picture. That's my experience anyway.
The exhibition, I Only Want You to Love Me, it's the largest exhibition of your work to date. Do you know how many pieces you've got in there?
Yeah, there's 55.
Is that quite daunting for you, the prospect of amassing this huge body of work in one place?
Yeah, it was very daunting when I was given the opportunity to do it. And it's taken 6 months to, you know, from thinking about it to the show opened last night. Editing the work, you work in a kind of negative way. So you look at all the work and you start taking things out that you feel you've already that's already been said in another image. This image is better than that image, and so forth. So you're going to whittle it down. My favourite part of the show is at the very end. there's a chapel. It's a kind of pop art chapel that you go into through a small door. It's a couple of degrees colder in there, which makes it feel church-like as well. It's all painted in this amazing fluorescent magenta, and it has these five Virgin Marys that I've photographed in 2007 in there. And and there's also a little bench that we put in for people to sit down and contemplate the.
And how does it work with an exhibition like this? Are you in complete control of it? And you say, right, when people come in, they're going to see this. We're going to have the chapel at the end, and then this is going to be the secret. Is it you in control of it, or do you hand that all over to someone?
In all my work, I love to collaborate with other talented people, you know, so, you know, the pictures themselves are taken not just by me. I mean, they're my ideas, and that's why the work hangs together as a body of work. But, you know, there's brilliant hairdressers, makeup artists and stylists that collaborate on this work. And similarly, you know, with the exhibition, I collaborated with a brilliant designer, a guy called Paul Neal, and between us, we went back and forth with these ideas of how the exhibition should be laid out, what the content should be. I saw a documentary on Diana Vreeland, and she did these exhibitions for the Metropolitan Museum in New York in the 70s. And each of those were, every time she did a show, it was the space was painted in a weird color, like a sort of pistachio, you know, green or a cherry red. And I took the idea, and when you see the show, you'll see it actually has 23 different colored walls that you step through, which present the work. It's interesting. The work becomes different with a field of color next to it.
Really? So that can influence?
It does. It influences your eye. You see different colors in the pictures. It's a strange kind of optical quality to it.
It's open last night, yes. Somerset House. It goes through to the 28th of September. What kind of people do you think are going to be coming along to this? Who do you think?
Well, Somerset House is well placed, you know, on the embankment. I think there'll be people that will hopefully be drawn into the exhibition using my usual trick of colour and beautiful women.
Well, this is the cover of this book is the poster that I've seen on the underground,
right.
of the lady in a yellow outfit with a drop dinner on the floor. It's better than I've made it sound, dear listener. Trust me, honestly, it's a little bit better than that. But it is an incredibly striking image, isn't
it?
Yeah,
thank you. It's become the kind of the McDonald's M of my show, you know, because this image has been the poster, the book, the postcards, you know, it's sort of ubiquitous around London now. So I don't know. I mean, I have a sort of a fan base. I think they'll go. I think I'm hopeful the word will be sort of spread, and that people are interested in imagery, interested in you know, the very word fashion in Italian is moda, means here now. So for me, you know, fashion photography is about representing what's happening now. So I think I'm hopeful that people are interested in the now, and the here will come.
When you take your pictures, you take them specific in London, do you use London-based crews, or do you have people that go with you all around the world to the various different places?
I do have. I mean, because London's my base, I have a very strong London crew, and it was quite funny actually. I was just in Paris at the weekend shooting for Italian Vogue, and
a great sentence. I was just in Paris at the weekend shooting for Italian Vogue. That's great.
And the idea was a Paris balcony is what I wanted to shoot on, but rather than finding a Paris balcony in Paris, because it had to be shot in Paris for various reasons, I instead had a Paris balcony made in London by my crew, and this Paris balcony was then boxed up and shipped over to Paris.
You're joking.
Unveiled in Paris, in his Paris studio. And we shot for 2 days straight in a Paris studio with a Paris balcony from London. Quite interesting.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's quite decadent.
It's very decadent. Did you ever dream you'd get to the level where you could say, no, yeah, we'll do it in Paris, but I'm flying over a Paris balcony from London? That's amazing, isn't
it? Well, I like the grandeur of that gesture, and, you know, I was once trying to find a hotel room for a photo shoot for American Vogue. It's not a bad sentence either.
It's pretty good.
And I couldn't find one for the life of me that had, you know, I could get the right angle on and had the right decor. And I talked to a friend of mine, this guy called Bill Mullen, who's a stylist. And I said, I'm having this problem trying to find a location for us, you know, to this shoot. And he said, he has a very deep voice. He said, hey, why don't you just build it? And I said, oh God, it's going to cost a fortune. And he just said, David Lynch would build it. And I thought, oh yeah, David Lynch, okay, good, let's build it. And so since we had that, you know,
David Lynch has been an influence as well with films like Blue Velvet.
Yeah, I think he was the one that, you know, really showed me that color and kind of horror, color and weirdness could go together. So what I'm really referring to is an amazing opening of Blue Velvet where it's the colored roses, and then 2 minutes later there's this chopped off ear in this bright green grass. And so I love the shock of that, you know, and it's I thought, since I was interested in color, this is a kind of a way I could work, you know, hence the spilt chicken dinner on the brightly coloured floor.
Miles, it's lovely to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For coming in. Miles Aldridge, I Only Want You to Love Me. That's the name of the exhibition. I'm not flirting with him on air. We'll save that for after. At Somerset House through to the 28th of September. Is there a website or anything that you...
I have a website, milesaldridge.com, and there's also another exhibition, just in case people need to see more than 55 images of my work.
Oh my goodness, look at you, go on.
Which is opening on, sorry, what's the day? Wednesday?
Oh, Thursday? I think we're on Wednesday Friday. The 10th, yeah.
Yeah, opens on Friday at Brancolina Grimaldi in London, in Albemarle Street.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Very nice to meet you. Thank you very much for coming
Thank
in.
You very much.
What a nice gentleman. What was embarrassing then, as Miles was leaving, the BBC London 94.9 team came in and said, right, can we take some pictures of you for the website and for publicity? They couldn't get the camera to work. So I'm there with one of the you know, the most renowned photographers in the world, and we couldn't get the camera to work. Dearie, dearie me. Hello, good afternoon. This is Ian Lee sitting in for Robert Elms, BBC London 94.9. 020-722-42000 is the telephone number. Notes and queries. We'll come to some of your answers soon. Mystery railway tunnel, army training film, and a mosaic near St James's Park. Can you help with any of it? Well, hopefully we'll find out a little bit more after 2 o'clock. Right now, though, let's get the travel with Pippa Sparks.
BBC London 94.9.
London's news. London's stories.
Hello, this is Ian Lee, sitting in for Robert Elms. He's back tomorrow, but can I say thank you? You've all been treating me very, very kindly today. I know, as a fan of radio, I know what it's like when the regular presenter isn't... Oh, I'm not going to listen to this Muppet. But you've been very kind, and we've had lots and lots of... It's true, though. You have been listening to this Muppet, and I gratefully appreciate it. I've been asking you several questions for notes and queries. We've got lots of calls about the mystery railway tunnel in Dulwich that Vic called in about. I think we may even have a couple of people, I'm surprised by this, may even have a couple of people who called in about one. We've had one who called in about the army training film that Roy and Addleston thought was shot in South London. If anybody knows anything about that, 020-722-42000. Now, the thing that I know for a fact we have had no response on is this mosaic. Okay, and I want to get, before 3 o'clock, I need... to get at least one answer on this. Go to the Facebook page and have a look if you want. I'll try and describe it. It's a mosaic. It's kind of bluey and grey. There's a picture of a nudie fella. His modesty is covered by a blue sort of towel. He's wearing a blue... Well, it looks like a hard hat. It can't be. No. That's what it looks like. Blonde hair. It looks like a young Owen Wilson. And written in kind of flowery writing is the word Victor... Lictor, probably Victor, as that is a real word. And he's holding a sword. Jim has posted this, and he says he saw this on a wall in St James's Park on the back wall of a house in St Anne's Gate. So if you, maybe you've walked... I don't know how big this mosaic is. That might be... It might be a tiny one. If you've spotted it, if you know anything about it, Victor, Lictor, what does that mean? Could you give me a call? I thought we'd get lots of answers on this. I'm surprised we've had a reaction to the army film and not this. 020-722-42000. You can email robert.elms@bbc.co.uk or start your text, or send a text, sorry, 81333. Start it with London. Now, listen, it's lovely weather out there. It's gorgeous. It would be criminal not to play a Beach Boys song. I love the Beach Boys. I'm one of their hugest fans. Although, have you heard the new Beach Boys live album? Very disappointing. I saw the Beach Boys live. Was it this year? Last year? I can't remember when. It was the original Beach Boys, the surviving original Beach Boys. It was great. They were old. They were very old. There was no prancing around the stage. Some of the harmonies, you know, but they're in their late 60s, early 70s. You kind of let them off. Then I got the new Beach Boys live album, which was recorded live, in inverted commas, on this tour. Well, I don't know how much of it was actually live and how much of it was done by a computer. I've never heard such tight, dare I say it, auto-tuned harmonies. And Brian Wilson sounded like he was double-tracked. Very, very disappointing. Anyway, I'm not going to play something from the Beach Boys Live 50th anniversary tour. I'm going to play a classic. Heroes and Villains. Oh, yes, please. Afternoon, this is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. Before 3 o'clock, We'll have Stephen Kellogg, formerly of the band The Sixers, coming in to play us a live song. That was the Beach Boys, Heroes and Villains. During that whole 3 minutes and 36 seconds, I was doing a huge rant to anybody who would listen about how disappointing the new Beach Boys live album is. Saying that, there's a Beach Boys box set being released, 100 quid on Amazon. You can get it cheaper other places, 80 quid I've spotted it, which has got 60 unreleased songs on there. I can't justify that expense. My wife has already recently told me off for getting too many deliveries from America and Japan from things that I bought on eBay. Do you really need to pay for buy all these things? How much did that record cost? Oh, it was like £4.99, closer to 50 quid. So I don't know if I can justify spending £80, £85 on a Beach Boys box set. I'm sure I can at some point. Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. Some of the questions we've had, notes and queries. A mosaic that's been spotted, which features a semi-nude gentleman kind of loitering by the word Victor. It's been posted by Jim. Anybody? Anybody? Give us something on that. 0207 224 2000. Mysterious army training film that Roy and Addleston called in about. He saw it in the 50s. He reckons it comes from World War II. Features, allegedly, part of South London mocked up to look like Germany. German soldiers running around. Teaches you how to dodge sniper fire and how to take down a machine gun point. Ring any bells? Was it in South London? Do you know where it's from? Have you seen it? If we could get a title of that, would be good. 81333. Start your text with London. And also this mystery railway tunnel. Well, Steve's in Purley. Steve, you think you might know something and might be able to help put Vic out of his misery?
Yes, I think we've done this query a couple of times on Robert's show.
Oh, a recurring query. There's nothing wrong with that. Go
well,
on. What?
He's on tunnels under things, and yes, it's an old railway tunnel that connected from Nunhead through to what was the old Crystal Palace High Level Station, which was finally closed for the last time in about 1950.
Vic says there's no track there anymore. So would that have been taken up when it closed down? When did they take the track up that they didn't use anymore?
Well, it had a bit of a checkered career after the palace burnt down in, I think it was 1937. And it was closed during the war, and they opened it up again for a few years after the war, but there wasn't any great use for the station anymore, because there's the other one at Crystal Palace as well. So they closed it finally about 1950 and pulled up the track then and took down the railway bridge as well that went over by the Horniman Museum.
So, the Horniman Museum, now there's a place. There's a whole three-hour special. It was one of my favourite places in London, is the Horniman. How long is this tunnel? Is it a big tunnel?
Well, I walked through it about 30, 40 years ago, but it's been closed up now. I think it's protected for bats. That's why they don't like people in it, apart from anything else, any safety issues.
These blooming bats. See, we can't go in there because there are bats in there.
Anyway, it's a few hundred yards. It comes out into a little council estate, which has been built since the tunnel, since the railway was closed. And then there's a second tunnel, goes through the last bit of the hills, and it comes out to where the old station was. And that's been built on now as well.
Steve, can I ask you a question? Roughly, how old are you?
63.
63, roughly. That's a very rough age. OK. At any point in your childhood, were you shown an army training film that taught you how to take down snipers and machine gun points?
Sadly, I'm a touch too young for that. I miss the old National Service.
OK, Steve, thank you very much. Stephen Purley. Well, he knows about the tunnel. These blooming bats. I'd love to get a look in that tunnel, but not if there's bats in there. Have you ever had a swarm? Are they called a swarm? Let's say they're called a swarm. Have you ever had a swarm of bats flying at you? A host of bats? An enclave of bats? What would it be then? There we go. 81333, very quickly. What do you call a group of bats when they're together? Have you ever had a swarm of, let's say swarm for the moment as a shorthand, ever had a swarm of bats flying at you? It's not pleasant. It is quite terrifying. The sound of the flapping wings and the squeak. Oh, it's not a good noise. I once, for my honeymoon, I'm going to show you my decadent lifestyle. Not at all. We went to the Maldives for my honeymoon. It was once in a lifetime, touch wood, experience. So we kind of splashed out on it. And we went to this amazing island. It was beautiful. You had push bikes and you rode around the island and it was wonderful. The one thing I hated about this island, and it's put me off Ireland, there was a bat, and this bat was the size of like an 18-month-old baby. It was massive, and at 4 o'clock every day, this bat would just swoop around the island. It was horror. It was disgusting, and all I could think about was, what if it got tangled up in my hair? Imagine if it... No, I have to. Imagine if it swooped down and it got tangled in your hair and you couldn't... And it was trying to get out and you were trying to get out. You were both panicking. Oh, it ruined my honeymoon and has cast a shadow of my marriage ever since. 020-7224-2000. What do you call a lot of bats together in one place? Alan's in Battersea. Hello, Alan.
Hi there.
You think you know something about this mosaic...
Yeah, absolutely.
This is the mosaic that has been sent in by Jim. It's on a wall in St James's Park, on the back of on the back wall of a house in St Anne's Gate. What is it?
I think the problem people have been having is it's actually Queen Anne's Gate, not St Anne's Gate, and therefore everyone's been furiously Googling the wrong thing.
Oh, for goodness sakes, right. Jim...
I just happen to know that road in SW1 is Queen Anne's Gate.
Listeners like you are so valued, Alan.
This is what I was thinking.
I'm going to say... Well, no, exactly. We're going to send you a reward of literally nothing, but...
Absolutely.
Jim, you are banned from listening to the rest of this show. Naughty Jim. So go on, tell us what you know about it. Alan?
I feel a bit of a fraud now, because all I'm telling you now is what I got from Googling.
Listen, I know we're the BBC, we're not allowed to fake anything, but just could you pretend that you know this, What do you know about this mosaic then, Alan?
Okay, it was an advert for the Victor Talking Machine Company.
Oh, all right.
Where they used to make old, EMI type, probably not EMI, that was another company, but you know, the players, like a Victrola, like a player with a horn. You know, his master's voice.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So it's an old kind of the record player type thing.
One of the original record players. Some of them use cylinders.
Yeah.
But anyway, the mosaic was actually an advert of theirs. And it's just been preserved. I presume it's been taken from one of their buildings.
Okay.
It looks very Art Nouveau in its design. And the period's obviously correct, but clearly it wasn't on the back of that house originally. And it's just been sort of lifted when some building was demolished, I'm guessing at that.
Well done, whoever decided to preserve that and take it and move it. It's interesting, because apart from the name Victor, it gives no indication at all that it's to do with records.
Which is why it must have been in context on a building. You'd have known what it was. I presume it was, you know, something looked vaguely like, you know, the Michelin building in the Fulham Road.
Mm.
I presume it was on a building of that nature, and therefore in context with, you know, the Victor Phonograph Company on the sign, it would have made perfect sense, you know, and it would have looked correct in context.
One of my favourite things about London, Alan, is sometimes when old buildings get taken down, but they only take down one building, so the buildings either side of it are still there. And sometimes you get to see really old adverts, that are probably 100 years old. It could be an old painting on the side of a wall or something like that, that's been completely hidden and is still there. And it's just those little glimpses of what London used to look like.
Yeah. To see old films of London, absolutely fascinating.
Oh, no, don't get me started. My wife hates this. If there's a film that pops up and suddenly you're seeing Piccadilly Circus from 1942, I'm like, whoa, everybody, stop. Yeah. We're watching this for the rest of the afternoon.
Yeah, well, you need to get yourself just your own television in your den, you see. It's cheaper than a divorce.
Alan,
one other thing.
Yes, go on.
I believe it's a colony of bats.
A colony?
I believe that's the collective noun for bats.
Okay, that sounds about right. Alan in Battersea, thank you very much. A man who speaks with experience. But I love it. I love when you watch a really old film, not necessarily because of the content, but when you see old London. Piccadilly Circus from the 1940s in film. Is there anything more majestic? I don't think so. Wonderful. Sorry, just to go off on a slight tangent, if you'll indulge me, Shawnee Mitchum, I'm sure you will. Talking about when buildings get taken down. It's very exciting when really old kind of flats and buildings and apartments get taken down. And about four floors up, you can see a bit of a chimney sticking up. Do you know, a bit of a fireplace sticking out of the wall. I love that. Oh, I love it. Sean in Mitcham. Good afternoon to you, Sean.
Good afternoon.
Sean, you may be able to help me with the mystery that I've been most intrigued with all afternoon. We had Roy in Addleston, who saw an army training film that he thinks was shot in South London, and South London was made out to look like Nazi Germany. Is Roy winding me up, or do you know something about this?
No, I do. I lived in Clapham, on the right-hand side of Wandsworth Road, going down towards Vauxhall. The other side of the road was then Battersea, and there was Stewart's Road. And in Stewart's Road was a large armaments factory called the Projectile and Engineering Company. Now, that was heavily bombed. The roads around there, Stewart's Road, Cecily Road, it was obliterated. And the army used to have a film unit there, and they would dress as German troops, mark the streets up, flags, everything, and they would have house-to-house practice, a scheme, you know?
Yeah.
Fighting, hand-to-hand fighting, and clearing houses. And there was quite often a film unit there, and we'd run around and try to get in vision, whether we did or not. I don't know. I've never actually
I always think this is kind of a new practice. When you see BBC News or Sky News or something, and there's someone behind the reporter pulling faces, you used to do this with the army, did you?
Not that exactly, no. But I've got a name for them. We won't go into
that. Thank you.
You would try. And they used it, I think, on several films. There was a huge, huge mounds of bricks there. Must have been hundreds of thousands of bricks where they cleared. And I think they used it in a few shots from an old film, Human Cry.
Oh, yes, I'm aware of that. Of course.
I'm pretty sure that always looked to me like that.
Yeah.
But we used to walk down Stewart's Road, down to the Dog's Own Bridge, which is the top of Nine Elms, and we'd walk down there to Battersea Park.
Have you seen the specific film that Roy's talking about?
No, I haven't.
Right, okay.
I wish I had. I wish I could find it.
Well, it sounds good, doesn't it? I'd watch that.
That was it. They used it, and we'd have to sometimes wait, and they'd let us pass. And all obviously squaddies, English squaddies, but with the shout abuse at those dressed in German uniforms. We was bombed every night.
Did anyone kind of take genuine offence and think, oh my goodness, we've been invaded?
No. I think it was well known.
Okay.
It was well policed, and it was well known. And we would go down and watch it.
Sean, listen, thank you very much. Oh, I do want to see this film now. Doesn't that sound great? Well, Sean in Mitcham, thank you. Well, we have an answer to it. Who'd have thought it? Have you got any more details you want to shed? Any more light you want to shed? 020-7224-2000. This is Ian Lee, sitting in for Robert Elms. Coming up in the last 30 minutes of the show, Stephen Kellogg's going to come in. He was in the band The Sixers. We're going to hear his new song, and he's going to play a song for us as well. But before that, let's have a little bit of Smokey, shall we? We answered all of the problems. Very exciting. If anyone knows the name of that film, that army training film that Roy and Addleston was talking about, that's the kind of thing I could happily spend an evening watching. Do you want to come downstairs and watch this? No, thank you. I'm going to be sat in the spare room watching an army training film from 1943. Why did I marry you? Shouts my wife up the stairs through a veil of tears. if you do know the name, do send me a text. 81333. Start with London. But it's coming up to 2:30. Let's get the latest news now with Anna Cookson.
BBC London 94.9.
Sean, you were there, weren't you?
Yeah, I was in the public gallery.
And how did you feel about the way the mayor handled it all?
It was embarrassing for London.
Eddie Nestor's Drive Time.
She'd love to get on the property ladder. Not in Battersea, Charlotte.
No. Weekdays from 5.
That's how we've come up with these figures. And they're really shocking. I'm sure your listeners will agree.
They may well be shocking, but what I can't do is I can't compare and I can't contrast.
Maybe in 10 years' time to down 5, so we can give them a deposit to get them
out. No need to change your name. I think that's absolutely right. Just get them out. Just get them out. Get rid of them.
Eddie Nestor's Drive Time.
Is that all right? Is that bad? Is that bad?
BBC London 94.9.
Afternoon, Ian Lee sitting in for Robert Elms on BBC London 94.9. It's only for today. He's back tomorrow. Sing hosannas, so don't panic. And thank you so much for all of your help there with the notes and queries. I was genuinely worried no one would call in with the queries and then no one would call in with the answers. Luckily, they did. Last 30 minutes of the show. Coming up, we'll be talking to Stephen Kellogg, who's a musician. He was in the band The Sixers, and we're going to hear his new song, and he's going to play a song for us in the studio as well, which is very exciting. But before that... A little bit of Mike Oldfield, shall we? Why not? Why not? Afternoon, this is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. Here until 3 o'clock, and then it's Harriet Scott sitting in for Joe Good. Now, joined by Stephen Kellogg. Hello, Stephen.
How you doing?
You're very keen and enthusiastic. It doesn't sit well in this country. Has no one told you that before?
No, I haven't heard that.
Now, I'm detecting an accent. You're from the United States of America.
Yes.
Whereabouts are you from?
Right outside of New York City.
And you said that it's even hotter over there than it is here.
It is much hotter over there, yeah. This weather feels great to me.
Is this like cool for you? Kind of
For this time of year, yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
But the thing they haven't... Everyone's got air conditioning, proper AC in New York, haven't they?
That's true, yeah.
So that makes it a bit more bearable.
Yeah, well, it feels weird, though, because you go from extremely hot to extremely cold, and, you know.
It makes you ill. You're going to catch some kind of bug.
I think it does, and I feel great here in London. So, you know.
Now, listen, let's explain who you are. You're a musician. Your new album, Blunderstone Rookery.
Mm-hmm.
First solo album in a long time. Last year, you took a break from the band The Sixers, who've been together for 10 years. Why did you decide to take a break?
Well, you know, they're my best friends in the world, and we'd all been out on the road in America for the last 10 years, and just some of the guys needed a pause from that life, but this is kind of the thing that I know how to do, so I've pressed onward, and, you know, no acrimony or anything like that.
Okay, so you're not going to give us the spiel about, oh, musical differences, which means one of them had a drug problem, the other guy I wanted to murder. There's none of that going on.
No, nothing quite so glamorous as that, I don't think.
So some of them are resting, I'm assuming, but you just pushed on ahead doing music on your own.
Yeah, you know, I just, at some point, you realize you've been doing this, and it's what you know how to do, and some of the guys are getting married and they're doing things like that. I mean, you know, but I have my family, and this is just what I do.
And know? Are you doing it completely solo, or have you got a new band together that's backing you?
Well, I went out and did a solo run, and when I the dates I've been doing here in the UK, and when I come back in the fall, I'm going to be doing solo stuff. But in America, I do have a new band backing me up, and I'll eventually bring them over to here too.
The reason you're here, you're playing tomorrow at the Barfly in Camden.
That's right.
You played there before?
No, first time.
Oh, it's good.
You're going to like
it. It's good, yeah. It's a cracking venue. And on the 24th September at the Borderline, Charing Cross Road.
That's right, yeah.
You're nodding. You don't know the dates, do you? You're assuming that I've got correct information.
Well, you know, never ask an artist for information because we're not good at this. But I think that sounds very good, Ian. I think you're exactly right.
For those who don't know, we're going to listen to your CD and then you're going to play us a song in a little bit. But what are your influences? Where are you drawing your strength from?
Well, I love the, you know, early 70s songwriters, you know, Jackson Browne and The Band and Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, one of my favorites, you know. But Cat Stevens was one I grew up with.
Oh, I love a bit of Cat Stevens.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my dad gave me that stuff to listen to when I was super young, and I just grew up with it. So that's a lot of where the inspiration comes from.
Tapestry, Carole King?
Yeah, of course.
I have to. No one else will be impressed. This is the book I'm reading at the moment, the Carole King autobiography.
Is it good?
This is a cracking read.
Is it? I love those.
She walked into a record producer's office at the age of 15. Said, "Yeah, I'd like to Don Kershaw. I'd like to write some songs." She played him a song. He went, "Okay, yeah, we'll give you a recording contract. Do you want to come in next week?" Isn't that amazing? She was 15.
That's awesome.
It's a cracky book. Listen, we've got your CD. I've got the vinyl as well, dear listener. Thank you for that. What's the song we're going to play?
Forgive You, Forgive Me.
Or Forgive Me, Forgive You.
I don't know. Now, is it the other?
That's what it says here.
Oh, man. I'm probably wrong. Oh, God. How embarrassing.
No, listen, you're the artist. You can call it whatever you want.
Yeah.
The name changes whatever
luckily
you want.
It's not out in the UK yet, so I have a little time to get the title straight.
This is Stephen Kellogg with Forgive Me, Forgive You, Forgive You, Forgive Me. We just don't know, but let's have a listen to it. Okay, well, that's Stephen Kellogg. I think we have the definitive title of the song. You've got the album. What is your song called?
It is called Forgive You, Forgive Me.
You got it right.
Yeah.
You got it right. I got it wrong.
Yeah, but I quickly abandoned my sense that I was right.
Stay
know?
True to your art,
I
Stephen.
Know,
this is
I
what
know.
You need to do. You've got to keep that integrity going, man.
Thank you, Ian.
It sounds great. It's perfect music for this kind of weather, isn't it? It is that, without being too flippant, it's that kind of sunshine sort of sound to it, isn't it?
Well, I think there's an optimism that goes through it. You know, I mean, it's not all like happy music, but I do try to keep some optimism and hope in the music. You know,
do you find it difficult to write songs? Do you ever just think, you know, I just can't do this anymore. I've run out of song.
No,
there's always something bubbling away.
There is, yeah. There's always something more to say. I hope it'll always be that way. I'm thankful that it is that way. You know,
listen, you have a guitar with you. It would. By the way. What a nice guitar it is as well.
Thank you.
It's a beauty. Now, yeah. it would be rude of you to come in with an instrument and not play for us. Are you going to give us something?
I sure am, yeah.
What have you got?
This song's called Lost and Found.
Okay, away you go. I'm getting that last little ring of the guitar. That was fantastic.
Thank you, man.
That's great.
Thank you.
Is it weird just coming into a studio and just singing to me, though? Is that not really intimidating? I know it's your job, but...
Well, you know, you're not intimidated. If you were more intimidating, I think it could be, but it's nice.
I couldn't look. I had to look away. Yeah. It sounds fantastic. You've got a cracking voice, and is that about anybody in particular? When you write a song, are you speaking to someone in particular? Or is it just like writing a fiction story?
You know, a little bit. You know, I feel like I'm talking. A lot of times, I'm just talking to myself. You know, and that song came because my kids are always losing things, and they came home one day. I lost my jacket for like the fifth time that year.
Oh man!
And I'm thinking that's a great jacket, and the fact that it's sitting in a lost and found doesn't make it any less great. And then it occurred to me the same thing happens with people. You know, you can get. Lost, you can lose your way, and you're no less, you know, worthy or good. But so, and I thought that was kind of an interesting idea that, you know, you can, you know, be sort of lost, and you're still, it's still a great jacket. You're still a great person. You just, you know,
Stephen, you'll always be a great jacket to me.
Hey, you will be a great jacket to me.
How old are your kids?
They are, they're all girls, and they're 8, 5, 2, and 10 months.
Man alive. if you want, I'll tell you how you get them, and you can stop doing it because maybe you've worked it out. That must be hard work.
Yeah, I mean, I know how it happens.
Oh, you
but
do
they're
know.
All surpri-
okay.
But they're all surprises, you know. But I love it, man. It's,
yeah, of course.
It's crazy, and I like it.
Do you sing to them at home?
Yeah, I do, but they're not impressed. You know, it's like.
You're not great. Justin Bieber, are you? That's
no, I'm not. I'm definitely not. Actually, I had an opportunity through my management to bring them to a meet and greet with Taylor Swift. And the thing that I remember the most is that my 5-year-old was bawling because we couldn't bring the cookies that we'd been eating in the waiting room. So she threw the whole thing. She just cried and was like yelling and I have this picture of her in tears with Taylor Swift, and I'm like, one day, honey, I'll tell you about this.
Fantastic. Yeah. You gave a TED lecture as well.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, and there are some, guess what, there are some people, even working on this show, who've only recently heard of a TED lecture. These are these huge, inspirational kind of talks that people like Al Gore, big names, get to do these. Now, no disrespect, but how did you get that gig?
You know, the curator was a fan of what I do. And so I got the call, and you immediately say yes, because it's an honor.
Wow.
And then you have no idea what you're supposed to say. You know, then it's terror for 2 months while you prepare something that is worthy of being listened to.
What did you talk about?
Well, I talked about job satisfaction, you know, I feel like over the years, I've kind of developed a few simple kind of steps that have really helped me enjoy work even when it's not good, you know, even when it's bad and it's hard. And I think that that's been a really useful thing that I wanted to share with others, you know.
What's the secret?
Well, I think the biggest thing is to just understand that, you know, everybody in every job, you know, has some vision that the grass is going to be greener on the other side. I mean, you know, so you have to sort of accept that there's certain rules of the game, you know, in every job that you're going to be up against, and stop sort of fancying that someone else has it better.
It's tough to do that, though, isn't it? Even when you know that realistically that the grass is never particularly greener anywhere else.
Yeah.
That generally, if you've got it, it's pretty good. It's hard to accept that, isn't it? And know that.
Well, it is, but if you use your imagination, you can get there, you know? I mean, and I think, you know, you really have to key into the positive elements of what you do. And that's like, everybody's job has some, even the pizza delivery guy is the one of the examples I use in my talk. But it's like, if that guy can view his job as you know, no good or whatever, or he can realize that he's bringing the best food on the planet to people's houses, and he's making and you know, at this point, I have this great pizza guy who brings me pizza every Friday night at my house, and when I see him, he's happy and I'm happy, and he knows he makes me happy. It's like, and I think it makes him enjoy his work more, you know, and I think you can do that with just about any non-criminal job, you know.
Well, even some of the criminal ones are very satisfying, although, of course, we would never condone them here. Do you come to London often? Do you get to play in London very often?
No, this is the first week. Last night was the first time I've ever played in London.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
How did it go down? Did people dig it?
It was great. I think so. They seemed to.
They throw anything?
No.
They liked it.
Okay. Is that the bar? That's for the litmus test here in London?
They're on your side then. They win. And for those who want to come and see, you're playing The Barfly in Camden tomorrow night, 24th September at the Borderline, Charing Cross Road. They're both fantastic venues. I think you're going to have a great time. Have you got another song up your sleeve you could sneak through? Would you mind?
No, I'd love to,
Away you go, Stephen. What have you got for us now?
All right. I'm gonna sing you a song called Men and Women.
Lovely. It's not rude, is it?
No.
But where you go then?
I would never. Okay. Here we go. No pick. All right.
Oh, fantastic. You're good.
Thanks, man.
There's always the worry. Whenever you do kind of a live session and a guest comes in, you always think, what if they're really bad? And you have to pretend that you're enjoying it. But that's fantastic. I tell you what I'm getting a little bit from your voice. Mm-hmm. This is a compliment. Some people might not take it as such, but please do. There's a hint of Neil Diamond. That kind of slight rasp.
I love it.
I hope you've taken that the way that's... Because some people go, how dare you? How dare you?
I love Neil Diamond.
Isn't he good?
Every time he comes on, I don't listen to him much, but every time he comes on, I think, why don't I listen to more Neil Diamond?
Man, you should get some of the early Neil Diamond albums. The fine examples of that kind of late 60s New York songwriting.
Yeah.
Wonderful. And you've just got that little rasp that he has.
Thank you, man.
Good. I was worried you were going to give me a punch then, which could have gone that way. Listen, Stephen, is there a website that we should be coming to look at to find out more?
Yes. So Stephen Kellogg. com, and it's spelled Stephen Kellogg.com. So much room for error. I mean, you know.
There's all these different. There's a Stephen with a V, and there's a Stephen Kellogg with one L, who's kind of hogging all your limelight. Yeah. Don't let them. Nice to meet you, Stephen Kellogg. It's lovely to see you. He's playing at the Barfly in Camden tomorrow, the 24th September. He'll be at the Borderline Charing Cross Road. Robert is back tomorrow from midday. Don't panic. He's going to be joined by regular film reviewer Jason Solomons. He'll have live music from Sarah Gillespie. And tomorrow, cover to cover, is Lowell. Is that how you say it? Lowell George? Is that a person? Versus, we're all shrugging our shoulders. Lowell. Oh, Lowell George. Lowell George. Now we know who that is. Yeah, of course. Versus Bonnie Raitt with What Do You Want the Boy to Do? Thank you very much for your patience in putting up with me. I've been Ian Lee. I'll be back later in July, fingers crossed. Right, let's go and get the travel.